Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 12th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Well, actually, not live. I'm not going to go through this whole thing again. I'm on vacation, folks, and I'm hanging out with my daughter. My daughter's name is...
Myla, M-Y-L-A.
M-Y-L-A. And she...
I love you. I just love him so much that he's being so nice to me, and I love him so much.
Are you talking about me?
Yes.
Oh, not so much with the hug. Okay, I've got a job here to do. Let's not get carried away. On the program today, Shannon Moore from Alaska. She does radio up there. She blogs at shannonmoore.com. Myla, don't say that. And, well, you could say it. I don't care. Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign also on the program today. I know you're going to enjoy it. I'm on vacation. It's all new interviews. These are both from Netroots Nation. Tomorrow, I'll be talking to the director of Hot Coffee. Great movie about what happened. It's about tort reform and what you think you know about that story about that woman who got burned at McDonald's by that coffee. You don't know what you're talking about. I can guarantee it. Nobody does. You got to hear this. It's a fascinating interview, fascinating movie. And then later in the week, we'll be talking to some foreign bloggers from Netroots Nation. We'll be talking to Marcos Melitzis. We'll be talking to John Aravosis. And I'll be talking to Senator Al Franken. Folks, enjoy today's program. Okay, hold on. So from Netroots Nation 2011, I am happy to be able to sit down and talk to Shannon Moore. She, of course, is the premier liberal talker in the state of Alaska. In fact, she is the only liberal talker on the Fox News Talk Alaska, I guess, network out in Alaska. And, of course, you can get more information at shannonmoore.com. Shannon, you've done a tremendous amount of reporting on Sarah Palin. Much of what we know from Sarah Palin in Alaska has been via you over the years. I don't want to talk about Sarah Palin. I'm quite sick with her, and I hope that she's no longer relevant. But there is a really important issue that's happening up in Alaska called Pebble Mine. Mm-hmm. And I want you to tell me about that.
All right. Yeah, there are things more toxic than Sarah Palin in Alaska. I know it's terrifying to think about it that way. But, you know, Sarah Palin's not going to be here in 1,000 years. And if the Pebble Mine goes through, the cyanide will be there in perpetuity.
Okay, well, first off, where is Pebble Mine and what's happening to it?
Well, I should probably talk about the area first. Bristol Bay is a region of Alaska that is one of the richest, most bountiful fisheries in the world. 60 million fish come back every year. Over 50% of the nation's seafood comes out of one bay in Alaska.
The 50% of the United States seafood comes out of this one bay. That's right. Stunning.
And Bristol Bay sort of slides down into the Bering Sea, which people watch Deadliest Catch, you know, of all the crabbers. I started commercial fishing in Alaska in 1978. And so I grew up commercial fishing. There are so many commercial fishermen in that region, but there's also subsistence, a lot of indigenous people to Alaska who have been fishing there for 10,000 years. It is a pure wild. We're not allowed to say organic because that word is like controlled by the government now. And they're not sure what those wild salmon eat when they are in the ocean.
And that's why they're not organic.
So that we're not allowed to use the word organic. But well, it is a completely wild protein source, right? And the largest wild protein source in the world. It's the largest salmon run in the world.
They are free of toxins to the extent that our ocean is free of toxins.
Exactly. Exactly. And so they make this remarkable journey, you know, 4 years, and they return every year. They have this little GPS system that they know exactly what stream to go back to. They will swim, you know, in an inch of water to get back to where they respond at. It's just kind of a remarkable thing when you, I mean, nobody thinks of salmon as being really, like, remarkable, but the GPS in there, like Garmin wishes they had. It's really phenomenal. But that region is very seismic. It's, well, Alaska is in general. The Ring of Fire, curious, the Ring of Fire that we live on, is also where the earthquake in Japan just happened. In 1964, Alaska had a 9.2 earthquake, bigger than the one that just happened in Japan.
Wow.
Tsunamis over 100 feet tall. And we had this thing called earth liquefaction, soil liquefaction, where the ground was shaking so hard for so long, over 5 minutes, that it forgot that it was ground and basically went liquid. And it was terrifying. And it was waving like water would. At the headwaters of Bristol Bay, where they want it, it's a proposed mine site. It's so seismic there, but it's also the aquifer. We're in the land of 10,000 smokes there, which are these vents, over 10,000 vents, because it's so volcanic. So we don't know how all the water systems hook underground, but they want to put the largest open pit mine ever proposed in North America there. It's 10.7 billion tons, not pounds, tons of waste. The tailings pond with cyanide and waste and copper would be 20 miles long. I mean, just the size of this, not to mention the location, has never been done.
No, wait. Now, what is it? First of all, what are they mining for, and who is behind this?
Well, first, who's behind it? Anglo-American, Northern Dynasty.
These are all major mining companies.
Well, Northern Dynasty's never put one in. They're sort of a speculator. It's a Canadian company. They've never done a mine before, but they're a speculator. They get the permits, and they work through the process, and then they sell it to a mining company like Anglo-American.
Okay.
Anglo-American, of course, a British company, so we've got Canadians, we've got Brits in there. Rio Tinto has about a 6% right now share. They've been trying to sell out of it because they just are like, we're getting a lot of flack from our shareholders.
What is it that they're mining for?
They're precious metals, gold, copper specific, huge copper deposit, but gold. Tiffany, the jewelry company, has said that they will not buy any gold out of this mine.
Wow.
And they're not alone. There's dozens of jewelry companies who have now signed on, said, we're not going to buy gold from you.
Now, are companies like Tiffany's and these other jewelry companies, have they made these determinations that they're not going to buy any type of gold from these mines as a function of what activists have been doing, or are they...
Absolutely. Okay. And because Native Alaskan people, sport fishermen, commercial fishermen, subsistence fishermen, have traveled. We've gone to London. Well, I haven't gone specifically to London. I've gone to D.C. I've gone to San Francisco. We've gone in and spent time and said, look, this isn't just what we eat that you could ship in. You know, there's a certain amount of providing for your family that the way that your culture has for 10,000 years. This is not just what we eat. This isn't just what we do. This is who we are.
So wait a second. So now we're talking about building this massive, massive mine. We're talking about the crap that comes out of this mine, ranging from just, you know, a lot of silt, I imagine, to elements that may be problematic for fish and whatnot. We're talking about an area where if this seismic activity ends up striking again, you're pouring all of this stuff, and never mind what they used in the context of mining. What is the supposed benefit for Alaska here? I mean, Are they renting out this bay? Is there some type of leasing that's going on? Or is it just simply there's some politicians who are sort of getting some benefit on their own?
Well, Alaska's been colonized, basically, by oil. 6 years ago, when people ask oftentimes, how did Sarah Palin get in? Oh, my God. And it's like 10% of our legislature were indicted for taking bribes from oil companies. It's very easy to buy a seat in Alaska. You can buy a Senate seat for $1 million. You could buy every single ad on every single radio station and television station and in the newspaper for like $1 million. So it's very easy to have a big influence there. The Democratic Party nationally has kind of written Alaska off. They're like, it's a red state. Alaska was protested to even become a state because it was too progressive. I know, you're like, no way. We have a privacy clause in our Constitution. We decriminalized abortion before Roe v. Wade. Women had the right to vote 30 years before American women. Native Americans had the right to vote Native Alaskans had before Native Americans. So, you know, it is a place that you can go in with a lot of money and have really easily bought influence. There's a lot of frustration in that for me to be like, we're worth an investment, you know, on a national level. But when the people out there are protesting it and saying that they don't want this mine, they don't want to give away their way of life, we are asking the questions, what's the benefit? Alaska gets 0.7% in taxes on mining. Less than 1%.
So are the only ostensible benefits, I mean, are we talking about federal land here?
This is state land.
Okay, state land.
But this state land the river system runs into federal waters because this is the headwaters of Bristol Bay. It runs right into Bristol Bay, the Nooshiak River.
So this isn't a situation where somebody's coming in. They're building this massive mine on private land. This is state land that is being sold
permitted.
Or leased.
It'll be permitted. Which is a lease.
Okay, leased to a company that is going to do this mining, and this entire industry in Alaska accounts for less than 1% of tax revenue.
Not less than 1% of tax revenue. Their revenue is taxed at less than 1%.
Their revenue is, wow.
Yes. So of the mines collectively right now in Alaska, there's one particular mine, Red Gold Mine, or Red Dog Mine, that actually in one day of profit pays the taxes for every single mine in the state. I mean, it is... And it goes back to the Klondike days. We wanted people to come to Alaska and settle and be gold miners in the big rush. And so they were really trying to get people to come and stay. And now we have this large-scale mining, and no one has had the political fortitude to be able to say, okay, we're actually going to make this. This isn't a renewable resource. On fish, we're paying 20% tax.
Stunning.
So on a renewable resource that we would trade for a non-renewable resource is so foolish. And the fact that, I mean, the majority of people I talk to out of Alaska are like, why is this even a debate? And I feel like I live in Crazyville because it shouldn't be. You should never say, here's something that we've had for 10,000 years. Alaska's been able to manage their fisheries, you know, pretty well. We have this great market. I was one of the plaintiffs.
Why would you jeopardize?
Yeah, exactly.
The one asset that is paying, right, like, that it providing 50% of the nation's. I mean, that it's like literally saying, like, you know, I'm a concert pianist. I think what I'm going to go do is some rock climbing with no. I'm just with my hands.
Right.
Or I mean, this is.
Or we've got this prodigy here, this child who is Mozart and Van Gogh and Einstein all wrapped up into one, and then we've got this babysitter over here who's been convicted of molesting children every time he's ever molested a child before. But we're going to let him babysit this prodigy because he realizes this one's special and will take care of it.
Right.
Like, and they've never been able to do what they are proposing to do and do it without killing the fish. So it is really ludicrous. And you know, I look at this and, you know, I was one of the plaintiffs during the Exxon Valdez spill. I heard them say, we will make you whole. My livelihood was destroyed. The suicide rates that happened, not in the first year or the second year, but at 4 years and 6 years, if the same equivalent of people kill themselves in the Gulf over despair of how they're treated by a corporation, if BP pulls the same thing Exxon does, you're looking at 45,000 people killing themselves. It was rampant despair, rampant frustration, and nothing we can do about it sort of feeling. So Alaska's already been through this process. It took us 20 years to get the Supreme Court to say, we'll give you 10 cents on the dollar. We've seen really relatively nothing new for safety. And, you know, having been up close and seen the Crexit and all the cleanup in Alaska, to watch the BP disaster unfold, there has been really very little advance in cleanup.
Right.
There has been a huge advance in exploration. I mean, now we've got fracking and we've got all these other things, but not in the cleanup. And when, at the time in 1989, I had one of the, remember the Macs? The Mac computers? I had like the Mac Plus SE, like the badass computer, because my parents were teachers and Apple had a good deal for teachers. And it was, you know, this huge box with this little tiny screen. You remember, and it's like you put the disks in, and okay. So 20 years later, I think about that computer and then look at an iPhone or an iPad, right? The technology between that and now, just in that area. And then I look at the pictures that I took from the Exxon disaster, and I look at BP. It's the same exact technology. It's the same ridiculous booms, the same horrible chemicals. And I'm like, this isn't a priority. And now the cost of doing business has been established through the Exxon v. Baker case. So Pebble's not going to be any different. When they're, you know, I've done town halls all over Alaska, had people from, and they always come, people from the mining company always come to see what we're talking about or what I'm saying. And I actually asked one of the heads from Anglo American, I was like, so can you tell me there'll be zero effect on the fish? And he said no. And I said, then you can't have your mine.
Okay, so this is obviously an issue that transcends Alaska, frankly. I mean, if
it
any
does.
Of us want to eat seafood again in this country going forward, the potential for destroying this resource that is an important national resource, where can people get more information and what can they do?
They can go to savebristolbay.org.
Savebristolbay.org. Okay.
And what we'd really like people to do is that right now, because this water, well, it's on state land, but the water flows into federal oceans.
Right.
It's under the EPA Clean Water Protection. So there's a section of that, 404C of the Clean Water Act, that we could, that Lisa Jackson, the Obama administration, could step in and say, you know what, we're not going to risk the nation's food security. And this is a food security issue. It absolutely
among
is.
Others, but
among
yes.
others. But nationally speaking, how it affects a lot of people is, other than we're going to have to pay for a Superfund site that's beyond anything that we've ever looked at before in this nation's history, there really is a chance that we can stop it through that. So I hope people will go check out SaveBristolBay.org and
SaveBristolBay.org. You can support those organizations that are fighting this in state in Alaska, and also support this fight by pressuring our federal government through the EPA to make a determination that under the Clean Water Act, this is too risky a proposition, could cause far too much damage to clean water and what we depend upon clean water for.
Well, that's why we have the Act. I mean, that's why there is the Clean Water Act, to make sure that they're able to protect the nation's interest. And this is of national interest.
Shannon Moore, thank you so much for talking to us. ShannonMoore.com, always a pleasure. Great to see you here at Netroots
Nation.
Thanks
to see you, too. All right.
I'm going to tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one.
Okay, once again, we are live to tape at Netroots Nation 2011, and I am sitting with the chair of the Courage Campaign out of California, Rick Jacobs. The Courage Campaign, of course, is at couragecampaign.org. Rick, give me just a brief overview of what is the Courage Campaign?
Courage Campaign is a 750,000-strong grassroots, Netroots organization designed to do two things, designed to make California more progressive and governable. And I suppose from an organizational perspective, the good news is we have a lot of work to do that. And because we're member-driven and member-funded, post-Prop 8, we developed a very large national following. And so we work extensively on winning full lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender federal equality.
So that's a fairly new mandate for the Courage Campaign, because I know the Courage Campaign has been around for
5 years.
At least 5 years. But following the national response to Prop 8, which was the which basically repealed the rights for gay people to
marry,
share the rights of everyone else.
That's right.
Your organization decided to work on this issue on a national level just because of the national support it got across.
Well, I'll tell you how. Yes, is the short story. But I invented the Courage Campaign, having chaired Howard Dean's presidential campaign for the minute and a half we had one in California. And I realized, this is 2003, 2004, the Dean campaign, of course, was the first campaign ever to really use the Internet for political organizing and fundraising. So we had 100,000 people on the Dean campaign email list in California, which was a lot at the time. And I thought, well, where are all these people going to go? And then the Kerry campaign came along, and that wasn't a pro-Kerry campaign. It was an anti-Bush campaign. And every 4 years, Californians export labor and capital for presidential campaigns, and we never build political infrastructure at home. So that's what we set out to do. Now, again, we're member-funded. People, we have, I think, a total of about 30,000 donors. And people send in contributions, and they do that based on things that they think are efficacious and that they care about. So in August of 2007, we had about 27,000 members. November 4th, 2008, the day Obama was elected, we had about 125,000. But remember that on November 4th, that same day that Obama was elected, was the same day that Californians voted against each other and said that, as you said, that certain Californians, gay and lesbian ones, are not equal and actually took rights away from them because it was legal for several months to be married there. That's the first time that's happened in the history of the union. It's never happened before, that rights were granted for gay and lesbian people to marry and then taken away. It's also, as far as I know, the first time that the Constitution, certainly in California, and I would think even federally, has been used to take rights away from people.
Right.
It's different to put a ban on. What this was it took something away using the Constitution. It constricted, not expanded rights. People were really angry, as you may recall.
I got to say, the most chilling moment, you know, I've been doing political talk radio since April of 2004, I guess it was, when Air America launched. The most chilling day, I think, of that in those 7 years was the night that George Bush went on to sadly proclaim that he had to support a constitutional amendment to discriminate against gay people. That was, I think, one of the most chilling moments I can recall of that of the past 7 years.
I will tell you, I blotted that out, but you're right. You're right. I think what happened, I've said this and people get upset with me sometimes, the best thing that ever happened to the LGBT movement, and I think to American progressives recently anyway, is the passage of Prop 8. Because up until then, I think a lot of folks took for granted that American rights will expand. Now, we've seen very clearly, you mentioned one example of a president saying, I want to use the federal constitution to constrict rights, and we've seen it in speech, and we've seen it in a lot of other areas. It is rare that you see a fight that is as clear as this one was in California, and that the victory is constriction of rights. So people were in the streets. People were in the streets in California. By November 15th, people were in the streets all over the world. I don't know if you remember that, but so we grew radically. We grew by the end of December. We had 350,000 members, now 750,000. And why did we grow? We grew.
That's stunning.
Well, we grew, it is. And we grew because of the following. During that campaign, no images of gay and lesbian people were used. We can debate or not debate the campaign, let's not, but they weren't used. And so we did two things. One is, immediately after the defeat at the polls, we went out and said, do you want to repeal Prop 8? And a lot of people did. The second thing is, we launched a campaign that became known as Fidelity. It was based on Regina Spektor's song, Fidelity. And here's what happened. On December 16th, 2008, Ken Starr, who I've always thought has a very peculiar interest in other people's sex lives, expressed that interest once again, and this time decided to sign on to a California Supreme Court ruling, a case that would not only have upheld Prop 8, but would have rent asunder the 18,000 marriages that had taken place. We went out to our members and we said, hold up a picture and put in the sign, don't divorce us, don't divorce California. We got 1,400 pictures in a week at Christmas time. We set it to this song, Fidelity, by Regina Spektor. She gave us permission. We put that out in early February, and the pictures were of gay and lesbian people getting married. There were videos of, you saw people kissing, men and women, men kissing men, women kissing women. And we got well over a million views in 3 weeks. And it hit a nerve. And the nerve was that people are tired of sitting around, and they're tired of waiting for someone else to take responsibility for all of our rights. So that's a little bit of history. And
let me ask you this. I don't want to relitigate, but my understanding of what happened in the run-up to Prop 8 is that it was twofold. That one, there was an underestimation of the proponents of this bill. And two, there was a strategy of let's just keep our head down and not sort of like shake the bee's nest, as it were.
I think that's right. I think you hit it on both counts. There's a third piece to this, which is that the anger and passion that brought people out onto the streets on November 5th, 6th, 7th, and 15th, and 30th didn't exist before. And so, I think...
They were a victim of their own success in some regards.
I think that's right.
Yes.
I think that's right. And so, particularly young... I'll speak about young gay men, of which I'm not one, but I've long graduated from that. But young gay men, in particular, were not very politically motivated. The day this passed, they looked up and they thought, wow, somebody can take my rights away from me.
Right.
I never knew that.
Right.
Now... I'm from East Tennessee. I know that. I know how that works, where, of course, there's recently a really dreadful law passed, which we should talk about. But and if anybody's from Montana or Utah, I mean, it's different. But in California, for the state of California, for voters to take rights away from people who otherwise thought that was impossible was a big slap in the face with a big wet carp. And I think it was a very important thing. One of the things that came from it, by the way, is this federal Prop 8 trial that Ted Olson and David Boies are waging, and they won. And what's happened with that, which is so powerful, is that trial that took place beginning January 10th, 2010 in San Francisco, and that was ruled on by Judge Walker on August 4th, 2010, that said that Prop 8 is unconstitutional federally. What that trial did was it lifted the covers, and you saw very clearly in the evidence that the proponents of Prop 8 were only using bias, prejudice, and fear. That's all they had. They claimed that wasn't what they were doing. And you also saw that every argument they had, which fundamentally boils down to one, this is everybody's argument, is if you have same-sex marriage and same-sex equality, my kids will catch the gay.
Right.
That's what it boils down to.
Right.
We will scare you if we're on the side of inequality. We will scare you, and we will say that homosexuality will be taught in the schools, which is ridiculous, and therefore my kids will catch the gay, which is also ridiculous. All of that was exposed, and all of that was shown not to be true.
So what is the status now? I know that there was an attempt by proponents of Proposition 8 to vacate Judge Walker's decision because he's gay. The argument being that a gay person can't rule on issues of, sexual orientation, much in the way that we don't allow women to rule on issues that dealing with women or white men to deal on issues that involve white men. Although, in those last two examples, we actually allow them to do that. But that failed. So where are we now?
Well, I want to just mention that one of the reasons Courage has grown so much and become such a go-to place is that around the Prop 8 trial, we set up something called Prop 8 Trial Tracker, which people can find at Prop8TrialTracker.org or go through Courage Campaign and find it. And we thought the trial was going to be televised because it was going to be put on YouTube, we thought, and everybody else did. But the day that the trial started, January 10th, the Supreme Court put on hold and 2 days later ruled that it couldn't be televised. So I went upstairs on that morning.
Because you could get gay that way, too,
You could get the gay by watching it on TV. Okay. Absolutely. So I went upstairs into that courtroom on January 10th and started live blogging the trial, which I did for the entire trial. And our site now has, I think we've had close to 5 million hits because we follow this trial. We've done a lot of the other stuff there. So I was there again on Monday to see this hearing in Judge Ware's court. Judge Ware is the new chief judge. He replaced Judge Walker, who heard the case and was the chief judge. And it's not usually interesting to hear the following, but it is in this case. Judge Ware is African-American. And Judge Ware asked the proponents, Charles Cooper, who I think probably is must be one of the most embarrassed lawyers in American history. He's the proponent's lawyer. Charles Cooper was sputtering in front of him because Judge Ware asked the following question. He said, if a black judge was hearing a case about civil rights, would you ask that judge to offer to either side that he should recuse himself? Well, and then the judge said, I know that you could tell if somebody was black. And he said the same about a woman, just as you did, and you could tell. And he said, but suppose you can't tell. And the audience laughed, and the judge called us to order. But the point was, Cooper had no answer. Because what they're doing, and this is what's so interesting, the proponents of Prop 8, who are so concerned about education in the negative, and who are determined to keep these tapes under wraps from this trial, the proponents are doing one simple thing. They're saying that a gay judge is not competent to rule on anything gay, and that his state of mind is important at the time that he's ruling. Now, the reason that got thrown out of court is because you take that on any issue, there is no issue that a judge could rule on where his state of mind maybe wouldn't be held to account.
Right.
So, at any rate, that the status right now is that this particular issue now will be appealed because the Prop 8 proponents want to appeal whether or not whether or not it should be vacated.
Okay.
They also, there's going to be a hearing on August 29th as to whether or not the tapes should be released. And then on
the tapes
of the trial, the videotapes. And then we've got a Supreme Court, state Supreme Court hearing on a procedural issue. And then maybe the Ninth Circuit by the end of this year will be able to rule on whether or not gays and lesbians should marry in California, and I think they'll rule that they can.
Well, I wish you the best of luck in that regard, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that I do think Proposition 8 was an anomaly that was brought about by a certain overconfidence, and I think for the most part, the effectiveness of those type of ballot initiatives have gone away, which is why we see less and less of them in some respect. They were a major electoral tool for the Republicans back in 2004, but it doesn't exist as much, and I think, but it's also easy to get complacent about this. Well, there's still very much to be fought. Now, let me ask you this, and this is a theme that has come up here at Netroots Nation, that as progressives look at a model in which to force federal politics to move in a more progressive direction. One of the models they're looking at, in fact, the most successful model, at least perceived by people here, I think, that I've spoken to, is what happened with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal and Defense of Marriage Act, where the Obama administration has now basically said, we're not going to defend this law. When it's challenged through our Department of Justice. Is that your sense that this is a model for progressives who are looking to push the president in a more progressive notion? Because I'm curious as your perspective, because I have a slightly different take on this, but I want to hear yours.
Well, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The president made it a campaign promise. It was a campaign promise, and it took him a while to deliver on it. 2 points on that. Number one, Courage Campaign and other organizations played a very big role moving outside of Washington. And I think you cannot underestimate the power of the storytelling campaign that we did around that and others, and the power of organizing military families that we and others did, all outside of D.C., all in key congressional and districts and Senate states. To make clear that this wasn't an inside Washington activity. It wasn't as if a president came along and said, we're going to change something that's been on the books since 1993. It was that the time had come. And so I think from that, that was one. And number two was leadership. There was a guy named Patrick Murphy, who at the time was in the House of Representatives, and I hope soon will be Attorney General of Pennsylvania, who was an Army captain who took this on and made it happen. Now, I say both of those because from the model point of view that you're talking about, the key is, I think, it is storytelling. And it is transmission of stories, using those stories in order to convince people in a community and then ultimately to build a movement to convince legislators that, that the time has come for change.
Do you, what about the aspect of direct action? A lot of people talk about Dan Choi, Lieutenant Dan Choi, handcuffing himself to a White House gate. What role do you think that plays?
I think that we were a very early... exponent of Dan's. Dan's from Orange County, California, and we gathered over 500,000 signatures around repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Dan was very much key to that, and we could go talk about that. But I think that the first time Dan chained himself to the White House fence was really a great idea. I think it was great. It nothing like that had been done in a long time. Dan understands, frankly, political theater very well.
Right.
He's a very attractive guy. He knew what he was doing. And I think that had a very big effect. I'm not sure that subsequent things had as big an effect. In fact, I'm pretty sure they did not. So I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
Well, I mean, I'm curious because, like I say, it is being talked about as a model, maybe both aspects of it on some level. And I wonder if you perceive it as one. Because the one thing that I have some questions about is, do you perceive, in terms of pressuring the Obama administration to move on this, because they clearly moved on this,
yes,
at the very least, sooner than they had wanted to. I believe this is a card that that I think Democrats like to play at certain times to provide themselves with certain liberal bona fides when they won't move in certain other areas. But one thing that occurs to me is that I wonder if the strength of the lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual community is one of electoral strength or fundraising strength. In other words, as opposed to, let's say, the Latino community, which the issue, I think, is withholding their votes. The idea is we've got to get the Latino community to come out to vote. If they vote in numbers that are on par with other people, that's a big win. In the gay community, I wonder if the strength of that community is a fundraising one, and if those bases of power from those two different communities come from a different type, if the tactics within the context of that each one of those communities uses are have to be different.
I think so. I also think you can borrow from each other. Look, there's no question about what you said. If every gay person in America decided to vote a different way, it is unlikely that that would have a demonstrable effect in a presidential election. It conceivably could in certain congressional and senatorial elections. It is equally true that if every Latino person in America decided not to vote or to vote a certain way, it would have an effect. We saw it in California. Governor Jerry Brown was reelected, and we won every statewide office in history for California for Democrats, and Barbara Boxer was reelected because Latinos finally started to outperform. So it's absolutely true. Now, if you're asking if direct action is only applicable for a tiny minority community, by definition, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community is a pretty small community. It's a lot in absolute numbers. It's big in relative numbers. It's not. Should the Latino community adopt that as a
tactic? Well, I guess I'm asking from a more general perspective, because I think the implications of what Dan Choi did in and the stories that you're telling have the ability to resonate in the within the gay community because it is a smaller community. It resonates more easily because of the size of it, and the actions that they then take are sort of very much more individual. I mean, you could be talking about a percentage of that community, which is swayed by the broader community, which has the ability to really impact what's happening with the Obama administration because they have their donors.
Well, I actually don't think the donor community is germane in this case. There was a boycott called a couple of years ago, I think it was. Don't give money to the Democratic National Committee. Gay donors don't give money.
Okay.
It had no effect. They gave money. I don't think that that's the issue here. What's clear is that if only gay people care about gay people, then we're screwed.
Right.
Now, what Dan Choi did, which is super effective, is he was a very clean-cut, elegant, well-spoken guy who captured people's attention as a character in a major play. I can say that. And everybody knew Dan Choi. A lot of people did. He was the symbol. And I think that was so effective. And of course, then chaining himself to the fence mattered a lot. What I'm really getting at is people don't, you know this, people don't do well with ideas that are ethereal. You got to attach it to a face and a person. And that was true with so many, with a lot of the civil rights protests. It was people who were involved. And I think what, I mean, we know this, we all talk about it, what liberals often forget is that a bundle of issues is not worth very much, but one story is worth everything.
Well, Rick Jacobs, I appreciate you telling me the story of the Courage Campaign. People can get more information at couragecampaign.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost the drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted into